So, good afternoon. This is also very loud, right? Okay, is that, if I sort of talk like this, is that okay? Or, okay, if I get too close, then shout. As you can see, the technical problems continue to be a theme of this term. You may also have noticed, if you rely on the recordings, that last week's lecture has not yet been uploaded. Eventually, I did manage to upload the audio from the backup device, but there were problems with the recording. I'm hoping that this week's lecture will be no problem. It started very well, but we'll see. I'm still hoping to get the other one, the one from last week, with the video synchronized, uploaded. It was a week full of oral exams, so that's why I didn't actually have too much time to do this, but I'm hoping to give you what's needed as soon as possible. Okay. Another announcement is about the first assignment. If you haven't noticed, the deadline has passed. Okay. A few people don't seem to have noticed. If you haven't handed it in, please contact me by email, and then we'll sort out a way of solving that slight problem. I'm planning to return this as soon as possible. There was one very hopeful student who expected it back today. There are 280 of those, and as I said, I had exams this week as well, so I simply haven't, to be honest, I haven't even started looking at them. I wanted to, but I'm hoping to do this as soon as possible. You'll definitely get them before Christmas, of course, but I'm hoping that next week would be, I'm not saying too much now. I'm hoping to do this as soon as possible. Okay. Another thing that I'd like to briefly say is that I've heard from a number of people, also through the tutorial teachers, that it still isn't entirely clear to you what you need to know in phonetics and phonology. I'd like to remind you that I've uploaded the know list with the sort of bold-faced and not bold-faced, etc. concepts. That should be helpful. Beyond that, I want to make it clear that in the exam, you will not be expected to transcribe a whole word. Okay? It won't be a task in the exam to say transcribe phonetics using the phonemic transcription system. No. You will definitely get one question in the exam where you'll be asked to describe either a vowel or a consonant. And yes, it is sufficient to know what is on the table which I uploaded, and I am aware that there are minor differences between what's in the trapezium that I showed you and on the table that I distributed to you. If you do what's on the table, you'll be fine. Okay, I'm still looking at the small differences between the two, but don't worry about that. If you've got what's on the table and the descriptions there, then you'll be fine. And I'm afraid, yes, you will have to know, you will have to learn these by heart, or rather, perhaps the better thing is to, basically know the system, and then, if you know the sound, you should be able to come up with a description yourself. Okay? So don't learn each one individually, but learn them by place of articulation, manner of articulation, etc. Okay? I'm also at the moment preparing an online test, a test not in the sense of that you will be evaluated on the basis of this test, but I'm hoping to make it possible for you to, it's probably going to be some kind of multiple choice test, just to make sure that you can assess where you stand in terms of the input that I've given you, which terms am I familiar with, where do I need to revise a bit more, etc. So that's. I hope to be able to do this sometime next week. Okay. Yes. Can I remind you what I said in the first lecture? I really would recommend that you don't leave things for the end of the term. It is going to be more of what you've had in the last 2 weeks. not more of phonetics and phonology and morphology, but in a similar fashion, we're going to continue. You're going to get new terminology, you're going to get new concepts, and it's really a good idea to keep up with it rather than put it off for whatever reason. Okay. And I fully sympathize with anyone who wants to put it off. I probably would have done the same if I... I probably did the same when I was a student, but I regretted it as well. So it's just not worth it. Okay. I'd like to quickly come back to one point, one particular point that I made last week, because I simply forgot to make one important point, which I should have made, and that's got to do with this whole introduction of morph versus morpheme. Now, I'm not going to go through what is a morph and morpheme anymore. Just to remind you, I talked about the allomorphs, z and s, or rather the other way around here on the screen. So voiced and voiceless version of the plural phoneme, plural morpheme. Both of them mean the same thing, namely plural, and they are both different realizations of the same morpheme. They are two morphs, and they realize the same morpheme, and therefore they're called allomorphs. Now, so I introduced these two concepts, morph and morpheme, and later in the task I asked you to look for the morphemes, right? When in fact I should have asked you to look for the morphs, yeah? Because what you actually see are, of course, the morphs, the realization of a morpheme. Now, Finnegan only talks about morphemes, really, usually. Okay? This is okay, okay? I switched later to using morpheme only, and I think it's okay. Well, I want to make the point that it's okay to say morpheme as long as you know the difference between morph and morpheme. Okay? So, yes, usually people talk about ED being a past tense morpheme. Yes, it is a morph, okay? But people say morpheme usually in that context. And the main point I wanted to get across is that there is something like phone, phoneme, morph, morpheme, word form, lexeme, and all those kind of... it's on several levels of the linguistic description where we have this distinction between something theoretical, something abstract, and the realization of it. So, I personally don't mind whether you say morph or morpheme, unless I specifically ask for the distinction between morph and morpheme. Okay? Now, I've said morph and morpheme so often that I hope I haven't confused you any further, but I hope that's clarified something. Okay? Good. Today is the first of four lectures on syntax, on grammar. Okay? This is quite a large chunk of the whole lecture series. It's partly such a large chunk because I think it is fundamental to many aspects of the analysis of language or of our understanding of how language works. It's got to do a lot with the structure of language, the individual, well, the way words, etc., are put together, and that's why I'm putting quite a bit of emphasis on this. Good. So, just to make the point that it's not just grammar, or that it's not just grammar for grammar's sake, or syntax for syntax's sake, that we're doing this, I'd like to introduce a few thought beliefs, things the layperson out on the street might know, or might think to know, or might believe. I don't know any grammar. Okay? If you ask a lot of British native speakers, English native speakers, they think that they don't know any grammar. Or, in fact, English doesn't have much grammar. Most has been lost. Okay. Now, of course, yes, it's true, that statement is true. Something has been lost in the history of English, and you'll be hearing more about this. When you look at German, there are lots of inflections. Many of those have been lost in English, and we talked about inflectional morphology last week. And you will have seen that there isn't all that much around in English. Yes, that has been lost, but it doesn't mean that grammar has been lost. Okay. Also, and this is where it gets, where we get into a wider significance of the whole discussion, sloppiness leads to bad grammar, which in turn leads to emphasized communication, or worse. Now, this is a very old belief, and that's also related to this whole discussion of prescriptive use of grammar, prescriptive versus descriptive use that I mentioned in the first lecture. Here is a quote from Samuel Johnson in his famous Dictionary of the English Language, or rather the introduction to this. The established practice of grammarians requires that I should here treat of the syntax, but our language has so little inflection or variety of terminations that its construction neither requires nor admits many rules. Okay, sorry, this isn't actually about prescriptive versus descriptive, as you've just noticed, I'm sure. This is about the fact that there isn't all that much grammar left. Okay. Although he does make the point that it is basically about inflection that's lost. A variety of terminations. Now, as we will see over the next three or four lectures, there is quite a bit of grammar left, and it is actually quite important to look at those different aspects. But let's first look at those folk beliefs in a bit more detail. Here is a conversation between two people, a hypothetical one, but one that could indeed take place. It's Jim and Michael. "So I don't see why anyone should accept that kind of rubbishy remark," Michael says, pressing the point home. "But if you want to really get an insight into it..." You, and then Jim is interrupting. "What sort of language is that? Eh? To really get, that's typical of the careless way you people put things. If you aren't going to use proper grammar, I don't see why we should take your sort of view seriously." Okay. So we seem to have a real connection for this person between what that person considers to be a grammatical mistake and the kind of worldview a person has, and it draws he draws wider implications of this. What's the problem here? What's wrong with "to really get"? It's one of the standard areas of prescriptive grammar. Yes?
Well, I would have put "the really" after the "you".
Okay.
If you really want to get,
okay. What's wrong with "to really get"? Okay, you cannot separate. What you've just done it. Yeah. Can you not do it? Well, this is one of the questions, and this is one of the prescriptive rules. What's at issue? This is the infinitive. Anyone heard of the split infinitive before? Does this in any way ring a bell? I don't know whether you can see this. Oh, no. This is supposed to be... Sorry? Star Trek? Does the split infinitive in Star Trek ring any bell? Sorry? You watch too many films in the original... not in the original, but dubbed. Okay. Or maybe this is too old. I don't know. "To boldly go where no man has gone before"? Anyone heard of this before? Okay, good. All right. Okay. Now, this is what's at issue here. It's the split infinitive where we put something between the two infinitive marker and the verb. Okay, and that's apparently forbidden, or that's apparently a rule that people are supposed to follow, and if you don't, then you're a bad person, or you're at least a suspicious person. Okay? Let's have a look at those three options that we have, at three options, and only two are really available. This is the one that you suggested as the better version, okay? But if you really want to get an insight into it, and then we've got "if you want to get really an insight into it", okay? Well, one is correct, according to the prescriptivist's view, two is the split infinitive, and three is just simply not correct. Okay? Or, let's put it like that, no one uses it like that if you're a native speaker. I'm always very careful to say, as soon as I say this is wrong, okay, it's a question of whether it's used or not, but we'll come back to that question later. But in any case, what we have here is variation. Okay. We certainly have variation between number one and two. The native speaker extract, which was constructed, but which is actually checked, which was produced by a native speaker in the first place, suggests that people have the option of choosing between those two versions. Now, whether there is really a connection between sloppiness and bad character and all those kind of things, I would like to leave out for the time being. But what I would like to make the point, or the point I would like to make is that in order to assess this, you first need to be able to understand what this is all about, where the problem is, why this is supposed to be wrong, what's wrong with the grammatical aspect. And once you've got this, you can then draw conclusions as to, let's say, social class, other aspects of social life, or etc., etc. And that's one additional reason, or one reason, why I would like to do quite a bit of grammar with you, to enable you to be able to put your finger on to exactly where a problem or a potential problem or a potentially interesting feature in terms of social aspects might be in grammar. I've also made the point before that for those of you who want to who want to emphasize on literature, it is sometimes very important to be able to know what kind of syntactic feature a poet or the writer of a novel might employ as a stylistic typical feature of this particular person. So that's why we do grammar. But what is grammar? Or how do we know grammatical rules, etc.? Or let's basically start with something that clearly is not the way we would use English. The car, green, the door, red, with. Okay? It's very easy for you to know that this is an impossible sentence. Why is it impossible? Well, yes, because we say the green car with the red door, but that's not really an answer. We know that adjectives normally pre-modify nouns, okay? So we don't say car green, we say green car. That's a rule. And we normally have prepositions rather than postpositions. We don't say door with, but we say with door, well, with the door. Mm-hmm. In fact, different languages have different rules. In French, you can put adjectives after the noun. In other languages, I think some of you will be doing Japanese. I think in Japanese you have postpositions. Anyone doing Japanese here? Yes, postpositions in Japan, yes, she's nodding, okay. Yeah. So something that sounds absolutely wrong here in English is perfectly okay from the point of view of structure in English, in Japanese. So grammar rules are quite obviously language specific. But is it only about the order of individual words in making sentences? Well, have a look at this one here. This is a very famous sentence. You may have seen this before. Colorless green ideas sleep furiously. Is that a grammatically correct sentence? It's not. I mean, unlike the previous one where we had the preposition in the wrong place, etc., this is, from the grammatical point of view, a well-formed sentence. There is something wrong with it, though, of course. If something is colorless, it can't be green. And I don't know whether you can imagine that some... Well, can you sleep furiously? Well, yes, you can toss around, okay, and you could sort of say he's sleeping furiously again, yeah. But, I mean, not really. It's not compatible in some ways. Also, of course, human beings sleep, animals sleep, animate beings sleep, not really ideas, unless you talk about metaphorical ideas that are asleep. So there are lots of aspects wrong here, but not in the context of grammar, but more in the area of meaning or semantics. This is what we're going to do after we've finished with syntax. Now, for the next few weeks, we're going to be less concerned with semantics, less concerned with the actual meaning of words, but we're going to look at the rules in which, or regularities, rules in which words are put together in a sentence and the hierarchical relationships between the individual parts of a sentence. Let's start with one part, well, parts of speech, or sometimes abbreviated POS, P-O-S, part of speech. Part of speech basically meaning word classes. And I think many of you, or I hope all of you, have a basic idea of the different word classes, verbs, nouns, etc. In my time in Lancaster in England, where I taught for 3 years, I was actually quite surprised that many students nowadays in England did not have a general idea of what a noun and the verb and an adjective is. I sort of assume that this is a this is general knowledge here, but when it gets to conjunctions and things like that, then maybe it's getting a bit, well, getting a bit on thin ice. So I think it's worth spending a few minutes on that. But first I'll give you the traditional view, okay? And then I'll problematize this slightly. Here is what a primary school child in Britain might be told. Every name is called a noun, as field and fountain, street and town. In place of noun, the pronoun stands, as he and she can clap their hands. The adjective describes a thing, as magic, wand, or bridal, ring. The verb means action, something done, to read and write, to jump and run. Okay? How things are done, the adverbs tell, as quickly, slowly, badly, well. The preposition shows relation, as in the street or at the station. Conjunctions join in many ways sentences, words, or phrase and phrase. Okay. We'll be talking about phrases much more. The interjection cries out, "Hark, I need an exclamation mark." Okay. Now this is the traditional approach. Okay. Why is it traditional? Because it relies very much on meaning, for example. Well, I'll give you a bit more feedback on that. What are the linguistic criteria in deciding whether a particular word belongs to a word class, let's say the word class of nouns? Usually, we have three different types of criteria. The first one we have already seen to some extent, that's meaning, semantics. Okay. And I'll give you more input on that. The second one is morphology, which you now know all about. And the third one is distribution. And I'll make those points a little bit clearer now. What do I mean by semantics being used as a basis for categorization into different word classes? Well, for nouns, we can say it means names and entities. So, for example, cat, dog, table, hat. We have no problem in finding out or knowing that these are nouns. Okay. Verbs, action, processes, states, events. Okay. Be, stand, run, attack, build. Okay, fine. That's got to do with the meaning of the verbs, what they convey. Adjectives, properties of entities. Yellow, big, unknown. Now, the problem is that it is very easy to find exceptions to this. And one example that's typically brought forward in this connection is, what is this in terms of names of entities? Victory, destruction, globalization, happiness. Okay? These are very abstract concepts. They're not names. They're not things you can touch. Okay? It's not a major problem, but let's see whether there are even more major problems. What's the word class of teacher? Noun. Table. Noun. No problem. We can touch a table. You can probably touch a teacher as well. Something. Yes. Doorway. Doorway is possibly even a little, becomes a little bit less touchable. Is it the actual doorway or is it more the concept? Okay. Sky. To have a swim. Or arrival. Now, quite clearly, these are people, personal things, thingies. Okay? Now, doorway and sky are arguably also things, but it's becoming much more difficult to touch them, so they're intangible in a way. Okay? Because doorway isn't actually, it may refer to the actual sort of construction, but it's also the whole concept of something that you can go through. Now with have a swim and arrival, this is even further removed from the concept of entity. In fact, I think this is pretty much what we would expect from a verb. These are activities or events. But of course, we also know that these are nouns in a different way. So quite clearly, semantics alone isn't sufficient to come up with a clear-cut distinction between the different word classes. Just to make things perhaps a little bit or even worse, what word class is involved here? Apple? Noun, okay? Washing? Noun? Verb? Ah, okay, all right, okay. I am washing the dishes, okay, or washing, well, whatever you could be washing, okay? What's there? Yes? Okay, adverb, okay, could be an adverb, okay. A verb is a function, but we'll get to that, okay. Two could be a preposition, I'm going to London. But what do you do with a two infinitive marker? What word class is that? Now? Adverb, perhaps, in the more traditional sense? Today? In front of? In it? Okay. What's in it? It's an invariant tag. It's great, in it? Okay. Isn't it? Okay. Yes. Now, here we have, and this is something that I mentioned last time already, in front of is a preposition. The whole thing is one complex preposition. But is it maybe also a preposition and a noun and a preposition? In it, what is this? Is this, I mean, word class-wise, it's a feature of spoken language. Today, some people say that today is a noun, others say it's an adverb. People actually disagree about this. Some of the major grammars disagree about the status of today and now. Okay. But apple, well, in something like apple pie, is it still a noun? I mean, it somehow modifies pie. Okay. You can say this pie is more apple than the other, just about. So it's almost got some features of adjectives. And washing in washing machine, is this a machine for washing? Or is this a machine that washes? It's not quite clear, right? So there are many aspects that simply aren't quite as clear as teachers often like us to think. And particularly not when semantics is involved alone. Distribution. We know that there are tendencies for particular word classes to occur in certain slots or to co-occur with others. For example, if we see something and that is preceded by the, then we have a good idea or we have, this is a basis for the judgment that this might be a noun. Okay. So, the student. Unless, of course, we have the happy student where there is another word in between. Okay. But the does not usually precede verbs. Okay. Verbs can occur in certain constructions, in progressives and perfect constructions. So it's preceded, for example, by I am, and then the verb with the ing, in the ing form, or I have verbed. Okay. We know about adjectives that they can occur in the comparative or superlative, so together with words like more or less, or the most, or the least. So this is to do with distribution, what's around it, so to speak. The third one that I wanted to mention is morphology. We know that adjectives have certain inflectional ending, like comparatives and form the comparative or the superlative. Okay. So if we see a word ending in ER, then okay, there are other options, but it could be an adjective. Verbs have certain inflectional endings. Nouns have, well, sometimes unfortunately the same inflectional ending, and that was the point that I made when I introduced the allomorphs last time. But let's not get back to that now. So morphology can help you in determining whether something is a verb or a noun or an adjective, but if you look at it from the point of view of the concept involved, then morphology is really also distribution, because it's distribution within the word, okay, or below the word level. So really it's about meaning and distribution. Good. Those were a few thoughts on word classes and how we determine whether a particular word is a noun or a verb or something like that. Let's now look a little bit more into the sentences and look at form and function. These will be two major concepts for the next few weeks. I used to live in Lancaster, so I like Lancaster in spring. How can we describe this very, very simple sentence? Well, there are at least two ways of doing this. Or rather, the parts of the sentence. What can we say? We can say that I is a pronoun. We can say like is a verb. We can say Lancaster is a noun. And in fact, it's a proper noun. It's a name of a city. And in is a preposition. And spring is a noun. When we do this, we talk about form. We talk about word classes, we talk about form. Of course, we also can talk about function. I would then be the subject. What is Lancaster? The object. What is in spring? Let's leave that open for the moment. And what is like? Again, let's leave that open for the moment. But I think subject and object are terms that will be perfectly clear to you. When we talk about this, we look at function. Notice, by the way, that I put in spring together. Okay? I didn't say spring alone, okay, having a particular function, but in spring together performs a function. It is a phrase. Okay? It is a unit. Right, we have I already said, is the subject, and then we've got like Lancaster in spring. In what way is this another unit? Well, we have subject, and then we have predicate. This is a major distinction, or a major boundary between the subject, I, and then the rest of the sentence. But all of this will become clearer when we look at hierarchies in more detail. Before we do this, I'd like to look at this sentence and ask whether all parts of the sentence are equally important. Can you remove anything?
In spring.
You can remove in spring. Okay? You remove in spring. Why? Because it's circumstantial information. It's not necessary to make a grammatical and well-formed sentence. You can say, I like Lancaster. Not only in spring, I like it all the year long. Okay? Can you remove anything else? You can't say, I like in spring. It would be very odd. Okay. You can do lots of things in spoken language. That's another point. Okay. But, I mean, we're talking about this hypothetical sort of following the rules of grammar. Okay. Or, I like. Okay. Or, like Lancaster in spring. That doesn't work. Okay. So it seems that you can remove in spring, but all the other elements are required. If you have the verb like, you need something that is liked. That's a grammatical rule. It depends on the verb what is present or what needs to be present in the sentence. And some verbs require objects. Others don't. If you have a sentence like, the boy stumbled, that's okay. That's a complete sentence. So some parts of the sentence are needed to make it complete, while others are not needed. And the ones that are needed will perform certain functions, and the ones that are not needed will perform other functions in the sentence. Now, grammar really describes which of the parts are really needed, and how are they combined, and how they are combined, and where other optional parts in the sentence can be placed and how they stand in relation to what is not optional. You cannot say, I like in spring Lancaster. And there's a good reason for it. Because like and the verb, like and the object need to be next to each other. Okay? And you are basically putting an optional element in between two required elements. Now this doesn't mean that you cannot, that this is a general rule, that you can never put something in between two required objects. That's not true. But in this case, it has to do with the object and the verb having to be adjacent. Okay, here we have a grammatical sentence. The girl smiles. And the girls smile. Same structure, same function. What's different? Well, this is very, very trivial. Okay, I'm starting at the very basics. This is plural versus singular. It's got to do with morphology. So there are two inflectional morphemes involved, or realizations of the morpheme, namely the morph S, okay, third person singular in the first case, and plural in the second case on the noun. So, really the change is only on the inflectional morphology level. And I cannot say the girl smiled, at least not in standard British English, or standard American English, or standard English. You have a rule that's violated. If you have a singular noun, if you have a singular noun as subject, you need a verb that's in the singular as well. Yes, obviously. She smiles at the girl. She smiles at the girls. Both are fine. Why are both fine? Well, in the second case, the word girl does not have the same function in the sentence. This, I hope, is quite obvious. Okay. The relationship between girl and smile is not the same as what we had before. In the first case, girl was the subject, now it is not the subject. So, we have several things involved, or two things involved. The placement of those parts in the sentence, the position with respect to each other, okay, and then the correct word form, or in other words, the correct inflectional morphemes that are involved. So, grammar is really a combination of morphology and syntax. That's why we're doing morphology first, and now we do syntax. Now, there is something that's known as the rank scale. The rank scale talks about the different levels of description that we have in linguistics. And we've already, or realizations of linguistic features on that, on those different levels of description. We've already seen what a phoneme is. We've already talked about phonetics and phonology. We've already seen what a morpheme is. The next higher element is the word. After that, the next higher one is the phrase. Several words can be put together into a phrase. And these phrases can become parts of clauses that then can form sentences. And beyond the sentence, we have the text. Now, what we're going to be concerned with for the next 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks, is what's read here. That's the elements of syntax. Okay, I've introduced phrases and clauses without actually saying what they are. Let's look a little bit into more detail here. This very simple sentence again. The girl stumbled. And I'd like to have a bit more of a bit more complicated sentence. The girl heard that I blew the whistle. These are not the most imaginative sentences, I'm fully aware of this, but they allow me to make one or two points. Now, as a little task, even though you haven't heard all that much about phrases yet, can you, on the basis of your knowledge perhaps that you already have, determine the phrase boundaries and name the individual phrases, just to give me an idea of what you already know. Give you a minute, sometime in the middle of the lecture now to do this. What are the phrases and what are the phrase boundaries? Just a minute. Okay, minute is over. Any phrases here? Anyone? Yep.
The girl?
The
sentence is
noun
phrase.
Okay.
Stumbled.
Sorry. Stumbled verb phrase. Good. Okay. What about the second one?
The girl
is okay. The rest is the verb phrase. Okay. Okay. Heard that I blew the whistle is a verb phrase. Any other? Why did I put the whistle here? Yeah. Because it's another noun phrase. Okay. Noun phrase. Any other noun phrases? Possibly. I is syntactically in the same slot where we could have something like the girl. So, he or she heard, or she blew the whistle, for example. I can say the girl blew the whistle. It's in the same function, it's in the same slot. It's a pronoun, okay, but it's... Well, is it really a pronoun? I'll make that point later again. It's actually a pronoun phrase, but let's get back to that later. I is also a noun phrase. Any verb phrases? You've already said, heard that I blew the whistle is a verb phrase. Any verb phrase? Any other verb phrase? How many verbs? Two, exactly. If you've got two verbs, they're likely to be two verb phrases. Okay. Blew the whistle. Whistle is a verb phrase. Okay. How do we know? Well, we have a very useful concept, that of participants. Okay. If you have a verb, then usually you need participants for the sentence to be complete. Okay. If you have the verb blow, then you've got somebody doing the blowing and something that is being blown. Okay? Is this the only verb in the sentence? Well, there's another verb, that's why you said two. Okay. Namely, the main verb, heard. Okay. Now, what's the phrase boundaries here? Okay. And you mentioned correctly, heard that I blew the whistle is the verb phrase. Okay. Now, what kind of verb is here? Somebody hears something. Now, what is the something in this sentence? What is the object of hear? What's the object of hear? Well, you can find this out by replacing or maybe simplifying the verb, of the sentence. Heard me. Okay. Heard me, what's the object? Is she heard me? What's the object here? Me. Okay, clear. So, let's summarize this first before we look at the actual structure of this. So basically we have three noun phrases, the girl, I, and the whistle. And we have two verb phrases, blew the whistle, and heard that I blew the whistle. Can we get a little bit more structure into this? Is this perhaps a little bit easier to show? Okay. The important word here is hierarchy. Hierarchy, you can say that hierarchy is a concept that you would not like to have in, let's say, social context, etc. But in syntax, you really want hierarchy. Okay. Syntax is all about hierarchy and certain things dominating others. Okay. Let's look at this. Let's have a quick look at the functions. To some extent, I've already done this. Find the subject. What's the subject? The girl. Okay, fine. Is that the only subject? I. Okay, so both the girls and I are subjects. How can you have two subjects? Well, if you look at the sentence like this, I blew the whistle, then there is no problem in finding out that I is the subject. So, how is it integrated into each other, we'll see in a minute. Find the object. Any objects here? The whistle, I heard, I think. Okay. The object of the verb to blow. Any other object? Yes, you? Any other objects? Yes?
That
I blew the whistle. Yes, correct. Okay. Now, you said phrase. The whole phrase, you know. Is it a phrase? You didn't say?
Yeah, I said that.
Okay, yeah. Is it really a phrase? Okay. It's not a phrase, it's a clause. Okay. Why? Because, well, we'll look at that in more detail. Well, a clause consists typically of minimally a noun phrase and a verb phrase. Okay. So, there are several phrases in a clause. And sometimes a clause can be used instead of a phrase. It's getting very complicated. Okay. I'd like to visualize this a little bit, to make things a little bit clearer. How could we visualize this? Well, we can, for example, put brackets around it. Okay? But I'd like to opt for a syntax tree as a more intuitive option. Okay? And I would like to draw a few trees with you now. Okay? Yes, we're getting close to Christmas, so yeah. Christmas tree. Okay. The girl stumbled. How can we show this very, very simple structure? Well, we can say that the is a determiner or an article or whatever you want to call it. We can say that girl is a noun. And we can say that stumbled is a verb. So far, so good. Now, we've already seen that the girl together belongs, that the girl belongs together. What is it? It is a noun phrase. Okay. It's a noun phrase because the important word is a girl, is the girl, well, the word girl, and the sort of belongs to it. Now, stumbled is only one verb, but it is also a verb phrase. Because if it was a different verb, like, we would need more. We would need another participant to make the verb complete. And then we put an S on top of it. Okay. This is a very simple structure, and we can now see the major division between subject and predicate. It's major because it is at the very top of the syntax tree. If you are beginning to wonder whether you are expected to draw syntax trees at the exam, no. Okay? But it doesn't hurt to be able to do this. I'm using this more to illustrate what I mean by hierarchy. Now, this is the slightly more complex one. The girl heard that I blew the whistle. Again, we can start with the word classes. In a way, we are starting with the lowest of the four elements of the rank scale that has to do with grammar, or with syntax. Sorry. The, determiner, girl, noun. We can put this together as we had before as a noun phrase. And we know that somewhere up there, there is an S for sentence. But what's happening after that? Well, we have heard as the verb, same as before, as we had the girl stumbled. But now we have a case where hearing requires an additional element. We already know from before, with the girl stumbled, that the structure ultimately is like this, that we have a verb phrase and a noun phrase. And now, well, let's look at the other sentence, or the other clause that's in there. We've got I, which is a noun or a pronoun. Let's subsume them together at the moment. We've got blue, the whistle, blue as a verb, the as a determiner, and then the whistle noun. Can we put anything else in this sentence together? Yes, the whistle is a noun phrase. And in fact, we know that blue requires an object. So the verb and the object together form the verb phrase. And in the same way as the girl stumbled is a sentence, we have a little sentence down here, which together with that, which I will not at the moment name, is subsumed or is hierarchically lower in the syntax tree and which functions as the object to the verb. And now we suddenly have something that makes the hierarchical relationship of individual parts in the sentence a little bit more clearer. We can now see how all of this is subsumed under one S. And it's a clause. It functions as, well, it is a subordinate clause. How do we know that all of this is one unit? Well, we can replace it. We can replace it, not with the same meaning, but in the same slot, for example, with the word me. So, everything, the much more complex structure that we have down here, is in the same place where a single word could be found. In both cases, what's here functions as the object. A little bit clearer now? So, let's have a quick look at what happens in the syntax tree then. We have something that looks like this, A, B, C, D, and other elements. And I'd like to introduce a few terms that might be useful. And these are family terms. Mother. Sister. Well, it sort of makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, mother as the higher level or the upper level. No, it doesn't make that. Dominating the two sisters. That's, well, yes. Okay, yeah. But the two sisters are on the same level, and they both have a relationship with the mother, and actually, I think it makes sense, okay? Yes. Good. We also have the term node, okay? A node is something that you basically attach things to. What kind of things? Well, you have branches of a node, and then those branches may have other nodes on them that branch off again. So what we have here is two elements which are dominated by Z. Okay. By one, there is one little point. There is one point in the tree, one node, where everything which dominates everything that's underneath. Okay. So we can say that C and D are dominated by Z, and they form a constituent. They form a unit, which is a whole. Let's get back to the tree which I introduced. We can now see several constituents. We can now see several elements in the sentence which belong together. For example, the whistle. Why do we know that it belongs together? Well, because there is a node which dominates both elements, and only those two elements. This is a constituent as well. It is a constituent in the sense that all of this if you take it by the node, okay, and drag it somewhere else, for example, then everything that's underneath that single mode will be moved along with it. And we've got the girl as a noun phrase, which is also a constituent. Right, I'd like to practice this with you a little bit. And I would like you to draw two trees. This is, I said, you don't need to be able to draw them in the exam, but I would still like you to draw two trees for me. And I'll give you about 3-4 minutes for this, maybe 5, let's see how things go. And then we'll look at the result together. And I see that my time planning wasn't ideal for today. You're going to be left off a little bit earlier as a goodie for having to draw a tree, okay? Or two, okay. More about Lancaster. Lancaster is a historic town. Okay. I would like you to draw a tree there. That he likes chocolate is obvious. It's a bit of an odd sentence, okay? But still. Now, start with the word classes, and then think about which words belong together and form phrases, and phrases that perhaps form clauses, and what their functions are, whether they are subjects, objects, circumstantial information, etc., and then draw the tree. Okay? So I'll give you a few minutes to do this. How are things going? Do you need lots more time? Yes? Okay, good. We have time. any people being finishing already? Another minute, last. Let's go through that. Okay, let's start with the first one. I think the word classes should really be no problem. Okay, what is Lancaster? It's a noun. What is? It's a verb. Okay, determiner, a. Determiner, article, both are fine for me. Historic is an adjective, and now the word town is a noun. Sorry. Yeah, okay. Right. Now, the first important thing to say is that Lancaster is not just a noun; it's also a noun phrase. Why is Lancaster not just a noun, and why can we not just put a branch that goes straight off the node, the top node S? Here. Well, yes, it is true, it is only one word. Okay. But in this particular slot, in the space which is available here, we could have more than one word. We could, for example, say, my hometown is a historic town. And then my hometown would be in exactly the same slot, and it would be a noun phrase. So phrases can consist of a single word, and the fact that we still have those two levels, the word level and the phrase level, is because theoretically we could have more. Okay. For example, let's have a silly sentence like, students are happy people. Okay? Students, one single noun in the plural, okay, which also is the subject. And how can we show that we could have a longer or more of a noun phrase there? Well, we could say, young students are happy people. Or old students are happy people. In fact, even if we say students who do a lot of grammar are happy people, then all of this, students who do a lot of grammar, is what? It's still a noun phrase, because all of this is under the same node. Okay? I'll make that point clearer again next week. Okay. Right, next thing. What is historic? Anything, what's on top of historic? Is it a word, is it a phrase, is it a clause, is it anything, or is it just an adjective? Well, I would like to make the point, just as before, we had Lancaster being not just a word, which it is, with a certain word class, but also a phrase, the same is true for historic. It is an adjective phrase. Okay. Why? I can justify this by saying we could have said a very historic place. And then, if we have very historic and we want to remove it, we cannot just remove historic, because we have to remove very together with historic. We can say Lancaster is a town, actually wondering whether it's true, whether it's not rather a city. But anyway, that's a different discussion. Lancaster is a town, we can say that. We can say Lancaster is a very historic town. We can say Lancaster is a historic town, but you cannot say Lancaster is a very town. So if you remove one aspect, namely the head of this adjective phrase, then all the other elements that are part of the adjective phrase have to go with it. So that's why it makes sense to say that historic is not just a word, an adjective, but it's actually a phrase. All of this together forms a noun phrase. And this noun phrase and the verb together form the verb phrase in the sentence. Clear? Yeah? Okay. Now the second one. The second one is a little bit more difficult. Yes, I noticed. That he likes chocolate is obvious. It's a little bit of an odd sentence, perhaps, or a bit of an unusual sentence for one particular reason. Let's first have a look at the word classes. He likes chocolate. He, noun or pronoun, it doesn't really matter at the current stage, likes verb, chocolate, noun, is, verb, obvious, adjective. As we had before, he is not only a pronoun, a noun, but also a noun phrase. It is a noun phrase because in the same slot, we could have a much, much more complex thing. The man likes chocolate. That the man likes chocolate is obvious. That the happy professor who had a very long week likes chocolate is obvious. Okay? That the, the elephant, which we know is a very old animal that lives in, and all those kind of things, it's all part of the same entity that would have to be removed together if we moved the node somewhere else. Okay? We've got the noun phrase he, but we also have a verb phrase. Like something, you like what? The verb like requires a subject, but it also requires an object. So, like in the simple sentence that we had before, we have a structure where we have a noun phrase and a verb phrase. And notice again, chocolate is not just a noun, but it's also a noun phrase. Is obvious? Well, what is obvious? It perhaps is obvious by now that obvious is not just an adjective, but it's also an adjective phrase. Okay. Again, why? I could say very obvious, okay, or entirely obvious to you. Okay. And again, if I remove obvious, then everything that belongs to it has to be removed together. Okay. So, this is a verb phrase consisting of the verb be, and the adjective phrase obvious. Now, how does this all belong together? Well, there is this that, which I will now just call comp. Okay, I may come back to that later on, what it actually means, a complementizer. Let's not look at this in more detail. Let's just call it comp for whatever reason. Okay, how does it all belong together? Well, it belongs like this. Belongs together like this. Now, the price question, and also one of the last questions, or perhaps even the last question for today. What is the function of that he likes chocolate?
It's the subject.
Okay, it's the subject. What form does the subject have? I mean, we know that it is a subject because it is in the slot where we would usually expect the subject to be. What form is it? What is it? Well, it's an S. So what is it? It's not a phrase. It's a clause. Okay. So we have a clause functioning as subject. Normally we say a subject that's something like the man or the student or something like that. Typically, it is a noun phrase. or perhaps even only a pronoun as head of the noun phrase. But it is possible, and that's preparation for next week, it is possible for different formal realizations, not formal realizations, for different types of forms to have different functions. Okay? The fact that you have a subject doesn't mean that you have a noun phrase. Very often you do, but sometimes you don't. And this is quite nicely shown in this tree. Okay? All right. As I said, you're going to be let off earlier today. Next lecture, we will get more on phrases and clauses. Okay? We'll do more tree drawing. Okay? We'll get more practice, and then some more practice. Okay? So, very early today, I don't usually do this, but have a nice weekend and see you next Friday.